That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I'm doing really well. Doing really well. How are you today, Tim?
I am doing great. And in this episode, we speak with a couple of really interesting people. Angel, whose sister Georgia Leah Moses was murdered in 1997. And Maria, who is a very strong advocate and has become friends with Angel.
It was a really interesting conversation right from the get-go because we were trying to establish their relationship and how Maria came into Angel's life. And it was very cool to see and to hear how their really good friendship developed. And it was all out of the goodness of Maria's heart. She had heard about George's murder. She wanted to help. She wanted to make sure that she could use her resources because she works in the media industry, and she knew that she could help. She could put some information out there and maybe get some people to talk that might not talk and provide some sort of insight for Angel as she's looking into her and independently investigating her sister's murder that happened when she was 7 years old and Georgia Leah Moses was 12.
That's right. And Georgia Leah Moses was found August 22nd, 1997 in Petaluma, California, right off of Highway 101. And Angel and Maria launched a new podcast, which is really great. And we want you to check it out. It's called They Called Her Georgia Lee. And her name is Georgia Leah Moses. But the media had reported it incorrectly for a long time. And we talk about that in this episode in the interview. It's a really great podcast, and you got to subscribe.
And anyone with information about George's very tragic murder, please call the Sonoma County Sheriff's Office at 707-565-2185 or 707-565-2650. And anonymous tips can be submitted through a program from the Sonoma County Sheriff's Office called Silent Witness. And you can access that by going to Sonoma Sheriff, that's all one word, .org/silent-witness.
And make sure to follow them on social media. They've amassed a pretty great social following, so there are links in the show notes, and make sure to be a part of that. Okay, everybody, thanks a lot for listening. Check out our website at crawlspace-media.com. Welcome to the podcast, Angel and Maria. How are you today?
Lovely, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you both for coming on today. It's so good to see you and to speak with you. And we were talking before we started recording that you had done The Fall Line with Laura and Brooke, and you did Voices for Justice with Sarah Turney. And now you're doing our show, and I feel like those are tough acts to follow, and I have nothing but respect for you for agreeing to come on and give us some time as well. So thank you.
Angel, your sister, Georgia Leah, was unfortunately murdered. And Maria, you have you are an advocate, an incredible advocate. So I would like to just ask first about your relationship and how you came together to work on Georgia's case.
This is actually like one of my favorite stories because I really feel like it was really sent from God, just how it all happened. Maria reached out to me on Facebook almost a year ago. And she basically sent this long message. Like, it was super long. And I was like, my heart was pounding. I didn't know what she was going to say because so many people were sending me some of everything in regards to my sister in the case. So I wound up actually reading it the next day. And basically, she just said that she heard about my sister's case. She was a little bit familiar. Her dad worked on it or was a part of the sheriff's department at that time. And she doesn't know me. I don't know her. She's not crazy. But hey, she has all these resources that she could help if I was willing to accept it. And so it was a breath of fresh air, definitely, because I could definitely feel the sincerity in everything that she said. So I followed up with a actual conversation. And everything she said was just, she wasn't pressuring me. She told me that, you know, she had a background in the entertainment world and whatever I needed, she was willing to help. And it kind of just took off from there because simultaneously somebody else had reached out in regards to doing a candlelight vigil for my sister. And so that event kind of was like that catalyst to her really showing and telling me what she was willing to do. And from that, you know, she drove cross state 7 hours to be there for the vigil. And then, you know, she helps out with social media. She started the art movement and she's been my little therapist when I need it. Just overall an awesome person.
It's such a cool story. Congratulations for having this relationship and for trusting in each other. And you said that Maria wasn't pressuring you at all. Maria, when you got into this, when you decided to reach out, were you aware of the approach? Were you aware like how you needed to delicately make this relationship happen?
No. Oh. I mean, honestly, no. I just... the thing that propelled me to reach out in the first place was that I had sort of felt like there was something so much bigger than me that could be done. And I wasn't exactly using my career history and all my, you know, experience for anything good. It all had just kind of been project after project and nothing that meant anything, you know, and it didn't mean anything. And I had always remembered this from when I was a kid. I remember my dad, it really impacting my dad. So that was the approach I wanted to take was, I don't know anything about this and I can't even pretend to know how you feel, but I have all this stuff and all this time. And if you want it, I can give it. And that was it. That was really it. It was, I don't want you to feel like I'm trying to ride your coattails or become special off of your sister's name. And that was really, that was it. There was no delicacy to it. It was simply, hi, and here's what I got, and maybe it'll help.
That's awesome. It's so refreshing to hear that. And you're coming from a place where you were feeling like you needed to do something significant and you remembered this and you said that you remembered it impacted your father. Was he the one that introduced you to this? And why did it impact him?
My father was a deputy sheriff for almost 30 years with the Sonoma County Sheriff's Department. And over the years, obviously he had dealt with a lot of stuff and seen things that you would never wish on your worst enemy, you know? And right before he retired, his separation from the sheriff's department wasn't exactly amicable, I should say. He retired because a couple of years earlier, he had had a stroke and it deeply diminished his ability to do his job, but he was clinging to it, you know, paired with everything else and coming home to two girls that were the same age as Georgia. It was really hard on him, just accumulatively. And seeing how this specifically affected him, seeing a little girl who deserved none of this, and then coming home to two little girls that were the same age. Actually, I went to the school she went to. It was just so hard for him to wrap his head around it. So that's why, you know, it affected him the way that it did. And because of that, it affected me and my sister in this very sort of peripheral way, to that we had seen Georgia around. We knew all of her friends, but we hadn't actually met her. And that was my dad's same experience was, you know, he was a cop in our town. He'd seen all the kids around. He knew everybody, but he didn't know her specifically until this happened. And it was kind of mind numbing for everybody.
So you two paired up because of very different personal connections to this case. And you've launched sort of a social media profile that is really impressive. And the artwork, what can you tell us a little bit about that? There's some beautiful artwork out there, including the logo for your new podcast.
So when I first connected with Angel, one of the first conversations we had was how there were so few photos of Georgia in existence, or at least that she knew of. We hadn't yet kind of campaigned for her friends to send in photos if they had any, or we hadn't yet reached out to the school, which is its own story. But we had had that discussion about how there were just not many pictures because her family were not big picture takers. So I thought, well, here's a way that we can get the community engaged and that we can borrow other people's audiences. I mean, the number one rule of effective marketing is borrow everyone around you. And so we reached out kind of blanketly to everybody that was following us and asked them to share it with their friends. Hey, if you know an artist that wants to do a portrait of Georgia, please, you know, send them to our Instagram. There are plenty of pictures on there that they can choose from for inspiration. And the response was insane. I mean, we went from having one person bring us a portrait at the vigil, which was beautiful, to we now have almost, I think, 70 paintings, pies, even. Somebody baked a pie that like had her name on it. And you know, interpretations of various different kinds. You know, my 7-year-old painted flowers. So like there's all these different visions of Georgia that didn't exist before. And now there's so many of them. I mean, we made a whole book out of it. And so, yeah, that was kind of it. I was so taken aback by there was so few images of her. And yeah, I mean, given that there was such little coverage of her altogether, we had to put an end to one of those things so we could create more imagery, you know. And the as far as the logo for the podcast goes, that's actually a painting that somebody had sent us. And we gave it to a graphic designer friend of mine who turned it into our logo.
Well, beautiful. Very well done. And Angel, I'm curious, how does this make you feel?
Well, it was definitely something that I didn't feel like I was deserving of. Just because over the years, it was just not a priority. It wasn't a priority to the media, the police, all these different entities. So to have Maria jump on board and be so sincere and then expand her presence by bringing in the community and them being sincere and sharing, you know, all these beautiful portraits where now I have my sister in abundance. It was a beautiful mix of emotions. I remember the first one I saw was at the candlelight vigil, and I was just like, wow, like, you don't expect those type of things, you know, like someone to go take time out of their day to do something for you and they don't even know you. And so to have that constantly repeated it still is. It's unbelievable. Because, you know, before last year, my sister was just somebody nobody ever heard of, you know?
You said something in your answer that you didn't feel or you didn't think you were deserving of it. And I'm just wondering if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah. So, and, you know, looking at my sister's stories over the years from the few that were printed, it made it seem like, you know, my family was just this poor family. My sister was just, you know, a situation of her circumstance. So to have such generosity coupled with that, you know, I knew how I felt about my sister, but when you have her image portrayed by the world, it kind of does take a toll on you because it's like, okay, well, maybe that's why this didn't take place, you know? So to now have the flip side of that where everybody, no matter what the details of the story are, they come together to say, hey, you know, we care, we're standing with you, and this is what we can do to support you. It was like a complete 360, you know, where everyone else that was committed to the case should have taken a more sincere approach. They didn't. And then I have these complete strangers who in passing heard about my sister's story, whether it was through Instagram, Facebook, or you know, seeing a poster up, and now they're going out of their way to be a part of this journey. It's something that I could never repay them for. So I just, you know, constantly say thank you, but that doesn't do it justice.
And the media for George's case seems like it's been a bit of a mixed bag. Can you tell us how it's helped and how it's hurt a bit too?
Well, up until last year, it's been more damaging than good. The media was really the only constant that I had as far as seeing where the progress of the case was. So, you know, I would have these moments where I just do like a media binge and Google and see where the status is because, you know, the police, they were how they were. And it was always the same few stories, you know, and it was never, it's those stories that were printed weren't stories that you want to read about your loved one. You know, it wasn't, oh, you know, she liked cookies and she, you know, ran through the field of flowers. It was she was a troubled kid. And, you know, if her family wasn't like this, if her mom wasn't like this, then, you know, maybe she'd still be alive. And from my 7-year-old perspective, it really made me defensive because that was my big sister that they were talking about, you know, and even taking myself out of that, like, you don't want to read that about a 12-year-old, you know, who was murdered. So, you know, when I came public last year, one of my big things was being anti-media, you know, because I was a journalist in the military. So I understand angles. I understood you have the ability to create the story that you want to create. And so it was a real battle as far as trusting the media again and to really hold a standard where if you're not going to be sincere in telling my sister's story, and not coming from an angle to check whatever block you had in mind, then you're not deserving of telling my sister's story. You know, it's kind of like putting the bully in their place because even with that standard, there was a few different media outlets that still kind of tiptoed doing their narrative opposed to just being sincere and saying, hey, this is a girl who was murdered and her case is still unsolved. Like, don't bring in the politics, don't bring in other movements, don't bring in anything outside of telling my sister's story and telling it correctly.
Did the press get her middle name incorrect at times?
Up until the end of last year, everyone thought my sister's middle name was Lee. Even I thought it was Lee. It wasn't until I had a conversation with my brother, whom I reconnected with, ironically, last year, the crazy family dynamic. But her name came up in conversation because, you know, he would share stuff, but neither one of us are really big into social media. So it's kind of you have to kind of grow with it. Even though I did social media in the past, I don't like being present for social media. So it's kind of a do it and go, you know? And we were talking about, you know, one of the posts and pictures, and he was like, why do you keep posting Georgia Lee? I said, because that's her name. And he was like, that's not her name. And so we went through this long, you know, back and forth, and he wound up, you know, basically saying her name was Leah. And I was able to confirm that through her birth certificate. So me and Maria had talked about doing a podcast and a few other things to just really tell my sister's story correctly. And when the name thing came out, it was kind of like that salt in the wound. It was just like, man, you know, it definitely gave the name to the podcast, but it was just like, it really solidified how necessary it was to tell my sister's story, where her truth wasn't even in her name. You know, like at the very base of all the things that were done incorrectly that weren't given the due diligence, her name wasn't even correct. And it was to such an extent where I thought it was correct and it wasn't, you know. And fortunately, I was able, you know, to really follow up on that information and find the root cause of it. But it was a circumstance that we were able to kind of take and reshape for the sake of telling my sister's story and letting her be known for who she really is.
Well done. Yeah. And the podcast is great. And tell me, what's the story with this Tom Waits song? Did he wrote a song about Georgia?
Correct. So apparently he actually attended the first funeral. So there's two funerals for my sister. The first one being she wasn't actually there for. And so I guess it was like a community rallying where, you know, they put it out, people gave donations and all this other stuff. And apparently he was in the back of the funeral. And I guess after that, he felt compelled to write a song for my sister.
Do you like it or hate it?
I've only listened to it once. And I think knowing it's about my sister in conjunction with how solemn it is, in conjunction with his voice, it was just way too much to handle. So I've read the lyrics, but as far as like the actual song, it's not something that I'll be playing ever again, probably. So.
You said that so well. I mean, there are songs by Tom Waits that I can't listen to that I have no personal connection with. And because of his just how layered they are. And then you have his voice, and pretty amazing though, that he attended the funeral. Had there been any contact with him, or it was just as random as you're explaining?
I actually didn't even know there was a song. In 2011, 2010, 2011, I had saw Miss Leah Raleigh on when I did a Google search, and she wound up opening up a children's home in my sister's memory. So I found her, connected with her on Facebook. You know, she was just kind of telling me about the community that pulled together for the funeral and, you know, just keeping my sister's memory alive. And she actually informed me that Tom Waits wrote the song. So up until then, I didn't know there was a song. I'm sure I would have found it eventually, but I didn't know who he was. I was just like, okay, who was this person? And she's like, oh, he's kind of a big deal, you know? So again, it was kind of like, why? You know, why do you want to write a song about my sister? Like, you don't know us, you don't know me, you don't know, you know, our story, but obviously something about it connected with him enough where he felt compelled to put it on his album. So
he wrote it and recorded it. And I read in an article that he was going to not scrap it, but he wasn't going to put it on an album. And one of his children told him that he would be just as bad as everybody else if he didn't put it out, because then he'd be keeping her a secret still. And so that was why it went on to his album in the end. Something else that he said about the song was the reason he chose to do a solo piano, and there's no other instruments, I don't think, are in that song, was because she was alone. And that was how she lived, and that was how she passed. So that was, I thought both of those things were really beautiful. I tend to agree with Angel that that's not one that's going to be on spin in my house, but mostly because the closer I get with Angel, the harder it is to listen to the lyrics knowing the other side of it, you know, because this is an outsider's perspective and it's a beautiful song, but at the end of the day, it is an outsider's perspective. So being now an insider, it's very hard to listen to it. And, you know, especially the lyrics that Angel had pointed out before, that question God. I personally question God all the time, but knowing how Angel feels and her unwavering faith and how that was something that was constant in her family and with Georgia as well, it's hard to reconcile those two ideas.
Well said.
So does it annoy you a little bit that it's that he wrote the song Georgia Lee and not Georgia Leah, spelled correctly?
At first it did, you know, because when I found out that her name was incorrect, it really did something to me. You know, it's just like, how do you correct, like, how do you come back from that? You know, like, it's not a, oh, we printed it wrong on the shirt, or, you know, your seat placeholder for your seat was incorrect. It was like her whole identity was incorrect, you know? Naturally, that song being something that was a staple to her story, it was a bit infuriating. And I even trolled him on Twitter and the record company that he's with to be like, hey, you want to do a correction? But honestly, it's no fault to him. You know, if somebody is buried in their marker has their name as something, why would you doubt that? You know, like, he didn't know. And so, it's unfortunate. I'm glad that in time the truth came out, you know, especially at a time where we're trying to really expose all the faults in my sister's case, you know, prior to her death and following. So that's just one of the other things that's like, hey, you know, thank you for doing the song, but unfortunately you did it for the wrong person.
And there's a 5 years difference between you and Georgia, correct? And you were 7 when it happened?
Yes.
And is it correct that you were the one who reported it?
Yes. So the day, I guess, they found my sister's body on the other side of the county, we actually had the CPS and some police come to our house to question about a completely different situation. And during that questioning, I had brought up that my sister, I didn't know where she was. And so that actually prompted them to do the missing persons report. And when they came, they didn't even know that there was another person staying there, another child. So it's really, I would love to see what that report entails, you know, because that should have been done months prior. So the fact that it was done on that day, I just felt like it was one of those things where the necessary step was taken to put an identity to my sister, you know, because if she wasn't reported missing at that time, how much time would have passed, you know, and they had no way to identify her. So it had to have been somebody saying, hey, this person is missing. Match it up to the person that you found.
And you said CPS was the organization that you reported it to, and that's the Child Protective Services?
It was a CPS welfare check, but it was actually the police that came to my house.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yep. Man, then you were 7 when you did that. That's incredible. That, God, my heart just breaks for you. That's incredible.
It's unfortunate in a lot of aspects, but I feel like the necessary barriers are in place to bring attention back to what needed to be, you know, even with my sister being found. The only reason why she was found was because there was a broken guardrail that a worker had to go fix. So had there not been a broken guardrail, who knows how long she would have been out there. It's like, even in the negativity of my sister being murdered, there's still these sweet spots that still bring it back together. Like even me and Maria, you know, before Maria, I had a few other people that were helping me, but it was more of a distant level. So when Maria joined, it was like, we literally clicked. And I was like, man, like, we're so much alike, you know, creative wise, and just, she's so genuine and loving. And, you know, I'll call her at 10 o'clock at night and she's like, hey, how you doing? You know, like we're family, you know, and for her to come at a time that was so necessary, it's not coincidental, you know. And even with this podcast, you know, the diligence she has in it. She's taking it like it's her sister, you know, and you don't find that a lot. You know, a lot of people might say, oh, I'm going to help you. But at some point, it's kind of like, oh, okay, it's getting to be more overwhelming. And every time she sends me like the complete project, they'd be like, hey, what do you think? I'm like crying, because it's like she spoke from a place I would have spoken, you know, and that's not coincidental. So even in those negative spots of, you know, the media failing and the police failing and, you know, my sister being forgot about by all these different entities, there's still these sunflowers, so to speak, that are just like, hey, there's still hope. Hey, there's still hope. It's coming together. Just, you know, just keep doing what you're doing and everything will fall into place. And I feel like that's what my sister's story is. Everything is falling into place.
Sorry to interrupt, but I got to ask this. Did you just think of that sunflower metaphor right now?
Well, I was looking at a picture and then it just all came together. So
I just wrote down so frantically sunflowers and I underlined it. I have no idea why, but I'm going to keep this.
Well, sunflowers have sort of become the symbol of Georgia in a very... It's been such an interesting evolution. So I forget what the original sunflower situation was, but one of the women who had kind of been keeping Georgia's story, at least in the local eye, with petitions and various other things that she was doing, she had sort of just clung to sunflowers. And then separately, Angel, in her own life, before she ever even encountered this person, had sort of clung to sunflowers. And then when I met Angel, I am not entirely sure, maybe I saw this and it was like a subconscious thing, but when I made our business cards, because we were going to this vigil, we wanted to just have something to hand to people to make sure that they could get our email address without having to write it down or remember it, in case they had tips, I just put a sunflower on it. And there was no like, there was nothing before that, for me at least.
It was so subtle at that point, you know, because what really made the sunflower for me kind of come into existence was when I created my sister's website. And the purpose behind that was to be able to tell my sister's story without it being edited and, you know, oh, you only have 4,000 words available. Well, if I want to write 20,000, I can, you know. And the first story I was writing, it was just, you know, in reflection of the time I had with my sister and the impact she had on me. And I don't know why, but sunflower popped up, you know, and I was like, what's the deal with sunflower? So I, you know, Googled it, and it was very telling to my sister's spirit, because basically sunflowers always turn to the sun, you know, and I felt like that story of my sister, no matter how dark life was, she was able to find the light in a situation. And so it kind of just stuck, and then, but it was more still like a personal thing, you know, and then other people kind of started latching on, and I was like, okay, well, maybe I do need to kind of share this and not safeguard it for myself, and it just became her, you know.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
In a small town in Colorado, people turn to a family-run funeral home in their deepest moments of loss. Run by a mother and daughter team, the funeral home offered thoughtful services at a fair price. But there was a dark side to their business.
It was truly a house of horrors.
He said she may have dismembered him and sold parts of him.
I'm getting angry all over, a small sweat breaking out.
I'm investigative reporter Ashley Fonts, and this is the story of an unbelievable crime you've never heard of. A story of a funeral home that lured their victims in the front door only to sell their bodies out the back. From Campside Media and Sony Music Entertainment, listen to Cover Up, Body Brokers. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes, or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
Step into the hidden corridors of the past with Hometown History, where every episode uncovers the untold stories and secrets nestled in the streets and alleys of our own backyards. We bring history to life, revealing the extraordinary in the ordinary, from local legends to forgotten tales that shape the communities we know today. Tune in to Hometown History and embark on a journey through time right from where you are.
Do you find yourself captivated by the inexplicable, entranced by enigmas, and tantalized by the unknown? We are Shane and Josh Waters, brothers who will weave you through tales that have mystified us for years. From haunted hotels to inexplicable disappearances,
our episodes offer you a panoramic view of the world's greatest mysteries, leaving no stone unturned, no clue unnoticed.
With a gripping narrative, we invite you to join us on a journey into realms of the unexplained.
We're unraveling the mysteries that have perplexed humanity for ages.
So, armchair detectives, curious minds, and seekers of the strange, it's time to put on your headphones and dim the lights.
Dive into the uncanny world of the Mystery Inc. podcast and prepare for a journey into the unknown that you'll never forget. And remember, some mysteries are better left unsolved, but not unexplored.
Rex Sherman is a demon that walks among us, a predator that ruined families.
The LISK, Long Island Serial Killer podcast, was shocked when the news broke of Rex Huerman's arrest. After more than a decade of searching, law enforcement officials had finally pieced together enough evidence to bring formal charges against Rex Huerman. Initially charged with 3 murders, Huerman is now officially charged with all 4 deaths in the Gilgo 4 case. I'm your host, Chris Moss, and the LISK podcast will be releasing new episodes with interviews and fresh insight on the case as Rex Huerman awaits trial in Long Island. While we are relieved by the arrest, the LISK podcast team will be working hard to share new developments and perspectives as we get them. So please keep your eyes and ears out for new episodes, and if you haven't already, please listen to seasons 1 and 2 of LISK, Long Island Serial Killer, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program. Well, can you tell us a little bit about Georgia and about that impact she had on you?
So my sister was one of a kind type person. You know, she rarely got upset, and she was just always so big on making sure everybody else was good. You know, like most of my memories are with just us. And there's other people like, oh, yeah, you know, you remember when we went here and we did this? And I'm like, no. And I think it was more like a subconscious just keeping her close to me, where the memories with us with other people, I kind of just forgot about. And I just latched on to the memories of just us. But she was a ball of light. You know, she loved having fun. She loved joking. And she really encouraged me to be the best version of myself. You know, she was in a sense like a little drill sergeant, you know, when I was whiny and felt like I couldn't do something, she always would be like, yes, you can, yes, you can. And I could, you know, but she made sure that I was good no matter what, you know. I think that's what made it so profound that she wasn't around, because even in the midst of her situation, no longer living with us, she still came around and visited me all the time. You know, if I was being good, she would walk into the candy store, you know, give me 25 cents. You know, back then you can buy a lot of candy for 25 cents. You know, she just always made sure that at the very least that I was okay. And just looking back at me at 12, I feel like that was just such a profound awareness for a 12-year-old, you know, because you're kind of in that shift of being a young kid to exploring the world. And it's like, why would you take on the burden of ensuring not just your sister, but your friends and your, like, everybody you encounter, you put forth the best you so you could see the best them. You know, she was super sacrificial, and I'll forever cherish that.
I was going to say, I've never heard you describe it like that, put the best you forward so you could see the best them. What a just perfect way to describe your sister. Just, oh, anyway, had to praise that for a second.
No, that was beautiful. And you also said that for a 12-year-old, she had a profound awareness, I think you said. And knowing that, what do you think she would be today? What would she decide as her vocation?
Someone said that she wanted to be a nurse. And in hindsight, I can kind of see that. But I think with the way the world is now opposed to 24 years ago, I really see her being one of those, I'm not going to say Oprah Winfrey, but I feel like she definitely would be one that advocates for people. She cared so much about people that if something was right and it shifted to being wrong, she stopped the show. You know, it's like, no, like, you're not going to bully this person. You're not going to talk down about this person. You're not going to demean this person. So I don't really don't see her being in politics, but I definitely see her being on a platform where she's pushing for what's right. And that kind of gives me like a little fire because I'm super private, you know. I have a little bit of that push, but it's more like within my own space, unless I just see somebody really bullying somebody and then I'll step up. But now it's like, especially with the true crime community, you see so many families that are being bullied by the system and bullied by, you know, some of the people that just are super insensitive. And I feel like, I feel my sister, you know, revving up in me, and it's like, no, we're not going to go for that, you know? So, cause I'm real, you know, quiet. Like I had to really, you know, not be a pushover in just fighting for justice because it's a serious situation, you know? So I don't know exactly what her job or career of choice would have been, but I definitely feel like she would have been someone that a lot of people knew. She was passionate about positive change and she was passionate about making the world a better place. And whatever that entailed, that's what it took, you know? And I don't see her just sitting by and seeing some of the things going on in the world today and be like, oh, okay, that's all right. Like she would have spoke up about it.
And the investigation into George's case, I know it has been a little less than stellar. Can you tell us where it's at now or what the story has been with it?
So currently right now, the detective is investigating. There's a few things that are kind of like still we're waiting on responses for. They did say that they sent for DNA back in March, which was supposed to, initially it was supposed to be back in 30 days. And then in June, it was supposed to have been returned. So now we're just waiting. I'm just going to say it's because of COVID, but you know, I don't know how long it would take to have DNA fast ordered and returned.
It took 24 years so far. So I suppose COVID really had nothing to do with it. But that's just me
trying to be nice. But yeah, that's pretty much it. You know, we've given them people to potentially re-interview. And the last time we had a discussion, which was like a couple months ago, it was a, we'll look into that, but it hadn't yet been done. The end goal would really be to have an outside agency investigate the case. But I do want to possibly have my sister's body exhumed or retested before I move it to Texas for her final funeral. So pending how that goes would determine how fast we're like, hey, can you, you know, reach out to the FBI or some other agency that can give it the time and due diligence that it deserves? Because in the last year, we've been constantly saying, hey, you should look into this, you should look into this, giving them information. And then a few months later, we're like, so did you look into it? It's like, can you give us that information again? And it's like, everything we say, we follow up with an email, you know? So I don't know how much of the same information you need to have repeated. And I don't know if you need it written, spoken, drawn, you know, put in the sand, but you're a detective, you know, and your job is to solve cases. And the time that me and Maria put in, you know, is a lot. And there's been times where I didn't have no sleep because I'm like, oh, let me follow up on this information. You know, that's how I found my brother on my dad's side was in doing an investigation. So it's like, at some point, you have to take responsibility for the progress and for the lack. And unfortunately, it's been a lot more lack than progress. So if you're not qualified for the job, then you need to pass it on. But for the sake of now and what's priority, which is having my sister's body retested, because I feel like there's a lot of things that just don't add up as far as the details and the reports and stuff like that. Then you need to retest and then go from there. But we're waiting on that information to come back to see what they want to do.
So when you're referencing them and the detective, what police force is this? Is this Sonoma County? Is this?
It's the Sonoma County Sheriff's. Currently, there's one detective assigned to the case, which he claims that's been part of the issue, is having to balance cold cases with active, you know, cases, and then the cases that are still arising daily. And I understand that, but, you know, if I'm giving you information about, let's just say, a potential suspect, and I give you very pertinent details, at what point do you say, let me have a conversation or let me look into this? You know, I've given phone numbers. There was a situation where someone had shared information about clothes being found around the time my sister was murdered. And I forwarded that information to the detective, and I followed up a few months later, and he was like, oh, okay, I'll look into that. And then almost 6 months later, I was like, so, you know, what came with that? And he's like, oh, well, I would need her information to have a conversation, you know, for the details. I was like, no, you don't. Like, I've already connected the dots. All you have to do is go from one police force to the next police force to see if everything lined up and if it was my sister's. And at times it feels like I'm talking to somebody that's aspiring to be, you know, on a detective. And, you know, I definitely enjoy solving mysteries and stuff like that. But some things are just common sense. You know, there was a situation with the coroner's report, and I said, well, this doesn't make sense. And he was like, oh, well, you know, that was based off a coroner from 97. So that's from their perspective. I said, okay, well, you're in the case now. So what does that mean to you? He's like, oh, well, I'll have to look into that. So you've sat on a case for a year, and you, and this is just me, like, some things, like I said, are common sense. If it says somebody was found deceased, that means they were dead. There's no, well, they could have been half alive when they were found, or maybe it was a rope. Like, certain things just don't make sense, you know? So the more intricate the case becomes, I feel like the less common sense is being shown, and it's really getting more frustrating, because before it was just like, okay, you're not, you know, following up on information, you're not responding, and now it's like, do you know how to do the job? My answer is no, because the conversations that me and Maria have, you're the expert, you know, like, we're just normal folks that are trying to connect dots from what we find and what's being presented. And you're like going in circles looking confused.
And this is coming from Angel, who for the first few months that we were working on stuff together had to reel me in on my criticisms of the way things were being handled, who was handling them. And mind you, you know, my dad was with the force back then. He knew everybody that took these wrong turns and missteps and lack of due diligence at that time. So these are people that have, you know, had dinner with my parents, whose kids I play with, who's, you know, that I am adamantly basically throwing under the bus. But Angel is always the one reeling me in. So when she gets to the point where she's like, oh my gosh, I can no longer defend this, it's bad. It's so bad, because she will defend the goodness of people and their efforts and their attempts to the death. And I don't. So the fact that she's throwing in the towel on that says a lot.
And that's the thing. Like, I give you time to give a different perspective, because I'm super close to the case. So maybe I'm, you know, being a little pushy, or maybe I'm reading into something. But when the facts remain the facts and you don't see it as a fact, or you don't see it as something worth looking into, then it's like, okay, sister or not, like, you're the one that's seeing it for what it's not. Like I said, there are certain things that have come up, which is why I'm like, okay, well, before I move my sister's body, somebody needs to be an expert to say, this is what it is, or this is what it isn't, you know, because there's so many inconsistencies that he can't tell me. You know, I'm like, okay, if she was found and, you know, I'll just say this because it's not too sensitive, but there were things that look like defensive type wounds, why does the report say that there's no signs of trauma? Like, that doesn't make sense. You know, like, trauma is very specific. And so I'm like, okay, well, why does the report say that if there's things on my sister's body that signify something different? It's like, oh, well, that's the coroner. And I said, no, from your perspective as a detective, what does this mean? Oh, well, I have to have somebody look into that. So basically, you don't know what you're looking at. You know, like, it doesn't make sense. And that's on a light scale. There's details that are way more black and white that I'm like, you can't tell me you don't see what this is. And he doesn't see it. It's like the veil. And I don't know if it's like, oh, we messed up so bad that we're just trying to kind of tread super lightly with what we say. But the little faith I had, you know, I definitely still have the respect for the police force, but the faith that I had in them in solving my sister's case is like at a negative five. And at some point, you have to throw in the towel and call for help, you know? And I feel like that's where we're at, where, I mean, we've been past that point. You know, the fact that people should have been interviewed and it took you almost a year to finally interview them because they came to you saying, hey, you remember me?
I mean, I wonder what is higher on the priority ladder for them that's not a murdered 12-year-old girl. I mean, if that doesn't do it for them to say this is a priority, what else is there that's more important that they're doing more due diligence on? And to hear like new cases come in, so we have to do this and that. It's like, then staff better. I don't know. Like the mistakes that you're talking about are mistakes that podcasters should make when trying to investigate a murder,
right?
Not detectives.
Right.
And I get. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm saying, and you used the buzzwords priority because you said, I don't know what else would be a better priority. They literally told us this was not a priority. Like, they use the words, Georgia's case is not a priority.
Awesome. Okay, good to know. I mean, there's your answer.
Yeah, but even wow. With that, I'm like, if you need a cake made, and let's say you want a cake, and you're like, I just don't have time to make this cake. So me and Maria, like, you know what? We got you. We go buy the ingredients, we cook it, and we bring it to you, and you're like, smells like a cake, but I don't see a cake. And it's right in your face. It's like, okay, maybe you just don't want a cake because you're bringing up every excuse as to why this isn't going to work when it's right there in front of you. Like, the details are so definite where it's like, if you can't connect two dots from here, then you don't need to be a detective. You know, we've had conversations with people where certain information, super, super sensitive, lines up with my sister being found, and you haven't even went to see about that.
Don't get me started on metaphors. I love that you're a big metaphor person, and that was a great one. Where's my cake? Where's my cake? I thought you made me a cake.
Where's the cake? You know, like,
well, isn't the podcast you actually trying to shove the cake into their faces?
The bulk of the podcast is to have my sister's truth be made manifest, you know, because it's been overshadowed for so many years. But with that, it's kind of taking the pieces of the cake and placing it in front of them, because I feel like there's so many details that are relevant to solving my sister's murder, where it's like, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to be like, okay, y'all need to be looking in this area, you know? And if you're not going to look there, then I'm sure the people that listen are going to start connecting dots to be like, oh, okay, well, why haven't you ventured this avenue? Why haven't you, like, I think it was Sarah that was like, I haven't even seen a suspect list, you know? And it's like, not even a person of interest that you're like, hey, you know, we vetted this person. And one person in particular was brought up by three different people as in an interview as somebody worth looking at. And guess what? They don't have any of those interviews on file.
The podcast is dual-fold. We absolutely want Georgia's story to be told by the people who loved her, who knew her, and get that out globally, which is something that we're doing, which is pretty awesome. But the other thing is that Angel's catchphrase, I would say, is justice has no expiration date. And I would say that my version of that is that justice is not just one thing. So because, like she said, there's so many elements to Georgia's story and to Georgia's case and things that led up to Georgia's passing that have just been swept under the rug for two decades, we want justice for all of them, for every single person who failed her while she was alive and every single person who rode her wave after she died, every person who wanted to get famous off of saying her name, and everybody who hindered the investigation. That's what we're putting out there. But what got me all excited was her talking about the three people who had mentioned this, and then they didn't even write those people's names down, let alone take their statement seriously and look into that person. Three different people pointed to one person. But furthermore, one of their very own detectives gave them a person of interest that has sat on a shelf. Mm-hmm. One of their very own detectives. So he gave it to us and was like, you guys look into this.
Yeah. And that person actually had prior murders on their record. So, you know, it's
not just murders, child murders.
Yeah. Yeah. And what we're finding is there's like a few different scenarios that look like could be the thing, but you have to vet them to say whether or not. So the person that kept getting mentioned by all these different people, you should be able to tell me 24 years later, especially after I've given you some pretty in-depth info on this person. This person we looked into, they're not a person of interest no more. Like, you can't even say that. You're like, oh, what's that information again? Oh, okay, yeah. It's mind-boggling that I can give you the keys to the city and you still be homeless. Like, I don't get it. You know, like, I can't do your job because I'd probably be in jail. You know, like, there's a protocol to doing this, to solving a case, and you're not doing it. Not the flying out of state to interview people or digging up the body and retesting. I'm talking about a simple conversation. A simple conversation. You have people that you can easily be like, let me look into their record. Let me look into the, you know, what was going on at this time. Let me connect these dots. And you haven't even done that. So we have to dig further and pull up more information. I'm like, well, here's more. And you're like, okay, thank you. And it just sits.
And I just want to be clear that you said there was a person of interest who was a child murderer who a detective brought to his peers and it sat on a shelf and he turned around and gave that information to you because it wasn't being taken seriously at the police department. Mm-hmm. It's incredible to me. Do you still talk to this detective? Are you working with him still or her?
Well, I think they kind of got under scrutiny because they shared certain information with us and people didn't like that. But fortunately, we were able to get that information before, you know, the big dogs got to them. But that person that he brought up is a likely suspect. You know, it's somebody that needs to be vetted because they were in the vicinity of where my sister was. And even other people, other friends of my sister feel like, you know, hey, he was really sketchy, you know, and they feel like he could have been somebody responsible. But if you don't follow up, nobody ever knows. And that person has been sitting in prison since the early 2000s.
For child murder.
So they're just there waiting to be interviewed and there's not
they
even
have a
conversation.
Few more years left on their sentence. So,
and the detective that brought this information to us had, I mean, of everybody we've looked into whose hands this case passed through, he seems to be the only one who took it seriously and genuinely cared. He put together an entire class and took it to a cold case school and tried to just get other minds to think about things and see these details differently. And then he found this person of interest, located them in jail, and offered them everything he could possibly offer them just to get them to give any information or any indication that they were in fact the guilty party. And he was unable to do so. So he passed that off to the next person. It's not as though they're looking for this guy, you know, in a different country, like he ran to Mexico. He's literally sitting in a jail in Northern California. They can go talk to him whenever they want.
Yeah. Is that the person that they made the composite sketch of?
No.
Really? Oh, wow.
Different. Interesting. And the composite sketch matched two people that we know of. One is the person that Angel mentioned earlier that had three people pointing at him. And one is somebody that they arrested and cleared already.
Yeah. So it's like you have, it's kind of like, which door are you going to choose? You know, because each door holds a valuable key. And I feel like, unfortunately, there are just so many predators in my sister's life where now we have like five different scenarios and each one is so great. I'm like, were they all working together? You know, because it's so many details that are so specific to what happened, to who was around, to who was acting really sketchy afterwards. Like those people are still, nothing has changed. The only thing that's changed is the year, you know? So it's like, you guys have some work to do. And it's not a lot of work because what people are saying, it's kind of incriminating, you know, like the fact that this one person is in prison because he raped and murdered children and lived really close to where my sister was staying at. It's like, and was acting sketchy when they went to go ask about somebody else and encountered him. You know, there's like so many details that are like, okay, why are you now acting extra? And then there's this other scenario where these people are acting sketchy and, you know, they're really strategic about what they say and what they don't say. And then you have this other scenario. So you have like all these different scenarios where there's a lot of sketchiness going on. And I'm like kind of getting to a point where I'm like, maybe they're all involved. You know, like, I don't know, because something in the water ain't right. You know, and we talked about this before, but, you know, Sonoma County is really big on sex trafficking. And there's been a lot of political figures recently that have come under fire for that. So I feel like it's really bigger than what people see at the eye level. And until the detectives start putting a definite cleared on these scenarios, we just got to keep digging. We have to keep digging.
Yeah. And one of the things that we keep finding with all these spider web scenarios, it's actually the entire subject of our second episode from last week. It's everybody we talked to who knew Georgia in the last, you know, year to whatever of her life, everybody points back to the same group of people. Everybody that is tied to, from the guy that's sitting in a jail cell to this guy in the sketch to the phone call from the 7-Eleven to the, you know, the friends, the trips to San Francisco, everybody points back to the same group. And it doesn't feel coincidental at all. Mm-hmm.
And the thing about my sister and the specific people, I've even said the same thing. My sister didn't hang out with everybody. She had a group that she hung out with. And all these different scenarios are so close where it looks like different scenarios, but I really feel like it's one situation. You know, like your friend was next door to this person, you know, like, and for the police to be like, oh, well, we'll look into that. And it's like, I don't know what to tell y'all, but if they can't exhume my sister's body and test it or say, hey, we can put the order in to have it done and by this time frame, then our next step is like just cut out the middleman and go straight to who we need to go to, because I've never seen anything like this. Like, where you don't take, like, witnesses have to track you down for an interview. I have at least 5 emails where it's like, hey, you should look into this person because they have some information that can be very, very helpful. And then a year later, you're like, oh, okay, yeah. And they're like, so I still haven't had a conversation. Do you think I should reach out? Like, unfortunately, yeah, because obviously they're not going to come to you. And it's been that way since the beginning. You know, she was talking about writing down names of people interviewed. They didn't even write down who gave the reward money in the beginning. So now we have to start all over because pertinent information isn't being recorded.
Would you ever consider visiting and talking to the person who's in prison now, who's in jail now?
I tried.
Have you done that? Oh.
I wrote a letter. It wasn't returned.
Angel did more than just write a letter. She sent a picture. But... She sent a picture that was under no veil. And I know you have something to do with this. And I'm so proud of her for it. But I have reached out to the prison. And unfortunately, because we are not law enforcement, they will not allow us to speak to him directly unless he agrees to put us on his list.
But they can talk. The police can talk. They're what, like an hour, if that, away?
Mm-hmm. But you can still keep writing letters to him. That they don't prevent that.
Oh, we can harass the hell out of him, yeah.
But see, yeah. The thing is, he's up for release last year. I think he had 2 years left. And so, you know, with COVID and old age, I'm sure even if he wanted to say something slick just because it's like, who are you? You know, he's not going to do anything to disrupt that. So I will be monitoring the release date because someone said that that person was really diligent in looking for Georgia when she was missing. And I was like, when was this? Well, it was about a few days. So like I said, those little bubbles of people of interest, they're becoming one big bubble. And it kind of makes sense why people aren't talking. And then when people do talk, they only talk after somebody else talked, you know? So it's kind of like,
and then they, you know, backtrack.
Yeah. So it's definitely this game of timing, right? Which that was kind of my approach before, was to play nice enough to get that information. And now that I think everybody's been talking and they're kind of seeing that, okay, she's trying to figure out what happened, they're mute. I'm like, F them all, you know, and I don't really like the curse. So screw them all, you know, because it's like at this point, you've had the opportunity to say what you needed to say, you know, and what you did say was what it made you more likely to be a suspect than not. So when it comes to the podcast, we're not holding anything back, you know, not made a post, but if you're in the line of fire, you're going to feel it. And that's not being retaliatory. That's not being vindictive. That's getting my sister the justice that she deserves. You know, there's been so many people that victimized her. And the only thing right to do is to make it known if we have the facts to back it up. So if you're a friend, if you're a mentor, if you're a police, if you're the media, if your family, if you're anybody that took advantage of my sister and her life and death, you're going to get called out. And that's the bottom line. I had to go through my friends list, you know, because I had to try and play nice. And now I want whoever that might feel that I'm coming for them to know, like, we're not friends. We're not in agreement. You're on the wrong side of right. And so be prepared. When you feel like this could be talking about you, it is. And you have the option to state your case afterwards. And if you don't, then you said enough.
You've worked hard for what you have, your money, your assets, your 401k, and home. Isn't it all worth protecting? Nearly one in four consumers have been a victim of identity theft. LifeLock Ultimate Plus helps protect your finances with up to $3 million in reimbursement. LifeLock alerts you to identity threats you might miss. And if your identity is stolen, your dedicated U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. Let LifeLock help protect what you've worked so hard for. Save 25% off your first year on LifeLock Ultimate Plus at LifeLock.com/aware. Terms apply.